Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're continuing our consideration of the history of English towns, and we're in the Middle Ages. We're doing so in a way to try and sort of, shall we say, distract attention from the election, either from those people who have misplaced euphoria or those people who have suicidal gloom, instead of which think about English towns in the Middle Ages. It will be an antidote to whatever you are doing. And you may recall that I was talking about a growth in the early medieval period in the towns, quite a pronounced growth. Well, of course, as is often the way, growth was followed by contraction. And this long-term trend of population and economic growth with its related social and political consequences came to an end in the 14th century. And that had profound implications for urban life. Although since all the agencies of government remained in place, it was nothing comparable to what had happened with the end of Roman rule in 409, 410. The population was probably hit very hard by harvest failure, notably the Great Famine of 1315 to 17, by global cooling and by disease. And this culminated in the clearly traumatic plague outbreak of the Black Death in 1348 to 49. It's a bit of an insult to the people of the period who experienced a situation in which maybe a third to the half of the population died to suggest that in some way COVID was the equivalent. It's a ridiculous affectation, that. The Black Death was the ultimate in an unpredictability that affected so many aspects of urban living in this period, with epidemic fire and flood to the fore. So, for example, York had a major flood in 1315. And such floods were, I mean, obviously York's had major floods recently, but such floods could be far more deadly and disruptive than those today, as there was no comparable support network. Now, alongside rural depopulation as a result of the Black Death, there were serious problems for many towns. Infection spread most commonly in towns where people lived in very close proximity, much closer proximity than today, much more of a habit of people who weren't married sharing beds and so on. That was because of a shortage of beds, not for sexual reasons. And these problems provided an important context for the more general variations in developments that reflected local circumstances. So in other words, you have a general context that was difficult, and then within that you have local circumstances which might, in addition, be difficult. Trade at most markets and fairs declined in the late 14th century, hitting town life. And the resulting strains could be seen in the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. Now, the Peasants' Revolt suggests something essentially in the countryside, and indeed it covered much of southern and eastern England. But the revolt also affected a great many towns, notably London, Cambridge, Norwich, Bridgewater, Beverley, and Winchester. And this was a matter both of urban discontent, which could be considerable, and of the arrival in towns of protesting rural elements, notably, but not only peasants, as, for example, happened in Maidstone, in Rochester, in Canterbury, and in London. Now, after the crisis, municipal authorities, explaining what had happened to the central government and to themselves, always emphasised this latter point. They always said, oh, it wasn't us or our townspeople, it was these nasty rural people that came in. But to do so entailed downplaying an appreciable level of urban activism. Indeed, the revolt was triggered in part by an attempt to collect the highly unpopular 1377 poll tax in Brentwood, although the key actors there certainly were local villagers. In contrast, rebel townsmen were important, certainly in London and Bury St Edmunds, and in many towns there was no opposition to their seizure by rebels, for example, in Ipswich and Norwich. In some of the towns, notably Bury St Edmunds and St Albans, the revolt drew on urban opposition to the power of the abbey. Notably, restrictions on grinding their own grain and a prohibition on pasturing cattle on abbey lands. At St. Albans, the abbey records were burnt in the town square, prisoners were freed from the abbot's prison, and the abbot was forced to surrender the abbey's rights in a charter. Similar enmity led to a violent attack by townspeople on the privileged University of Cambridge, a revolt backed by the mayor, again with archives being burnt and a new charter issued. In Beverley and Scarborough, the poorer townspeople displaced the wealthy elite. Now, these varied factors captured the extent to which town life was fraught with rivalries, and periods of crisis could bring these to a head. Looking ahead into the 15th century, the economic problems of towns continued. There was no significant bounce back of population to the 16th century. And economic problems affected population numbers by resulting in later marriages and therefore a lower birth rate. It wasn't normal to get married until you were in a reasonable and economic position. The kind of, you know, rather feckless process today just didn't really exist much in that period. There were always some individuals who were doing that. Many of them would then be subject to regulatory punishments. Warwick was typical of several county towns enjoying a degree of prosperity, but also in bumping along. And where you choose to put the emphasis and the language you use is very much a matter of perception, of context, and of expectation. In the case of Warwick, it had its governmental position and a local market, but it didn't grow much because it lacked an industrial base. But on the other hand, there was cloth production centres on some towns, for example, Hadley, Lavenham and Long Melford in East Anglia. Those of you who visited in particular Lavenham, but also Long Melford, will see with the surviving houses from the period the great prosperity of the cloth industry, and ports such as Great Yarmouth and London acted to export this cloth. Although the particular rhythms of war and peace with France and the Low Countries and the resulting disruption to trade and export markets were important to the success of trade. The Great Yarmouth replaced Boston as the major regional port, which is Boston in Lincolnshire, which is a reminder of the extent to which, even if there's a general strength of an economy, in this case East Anglian cloth, this could read through into very different results for individual towns. So also in the West Country, with Exeter prosperous, but there was a relative decline compared to East Anglia. Now, the gradual switch produced a wealth that encouraged the link between the crown and mercantile interests, a link that was to be important to a more general and long-term association of government with towns. If you're looking at the 16th century, most of the disaffection is a matter not of urban disaffection, though there is some of that, but mostly it's of either peasants or rural elites. And this linkage took precedence over that between nobility and towns. The freeman's oath included a declaration of loyalty to the monarch, as the freeman was a subject as well as a citizen. Now, a recent assessment of Gloucester based on a 1455 rental suggests that 15th century towns were not necessarily in a grim state, which is the impression often created of towns other than those in East Anglia. Although there was open ground in Gloucester, in other words, no development in parts of it, it was mostly in the side streets and in the suburbs, while the thoroughfares showed competition for housing, leading to subdivided tenements, which is always a sign of population pressure, as well as activity by craftsmen and real estate development. More generally, many townspeople would have lived in great poverty, but that was also the case in the countryside. But those doing well are revealed by their inventories as living in multi-room environments that offered privacy, as well as living in lasting houses in stable property units protected by legal title from control by aristocrats. Moreover, the urban inventories of the 15th century reveal more goods, for example, pottery, and more furnishing than exist in the case of rural inventories. Inventories are things you have when you die, you know, the inventory of your property. If there were problems with towns, these were frequently to the benefit of other towns. For example, York and Beverley were hit by economic problems in the 15th century, but that was partly because they were passed as a commercial centre by a growing Hull. In rare cases, there were also environmental problems. The major instance was that of rivers and harbours silting up in whole or in part, for example, at Sandwich. More dramatically, the encroachment of the North Sea had made Dunwich, a once successful Suffolk port, unviable from 1328, and it was increasingly to be, as it were, covered by the waters. Some town fortunes and life were linked to the military. This was shown, for example, in Berwick-upon-Tweed, a major position in contention between England and Scotland until finally captured by the English in 1482, and again in Southampton, which was a naval base and one made more significant by the centrality of war with France in naval activities. The ports along the Channel were indeed greatly affected by privateering, by raids, and by the impressment of ships for royal service. Its population falling from over 2,000 in the late 13th century to about 1,500 in 1377, Carlisle was again a military base, which, you know, it had a major castle, and that was important, as well as being a county town, a cathedral city, and a site for markets and fairs. In contrast, Chester was no longer a major military base, as North Wales was finally brought under control with the failure of Owen Glendower's rising in the early 15th century. But on the other hand, Chester remained of major significance as a regional centre. Restructuring, in other words, rather than decay, might be the prime theme for the 15th century, not least due to the growth of service and commercial sectors, the vitality of the cloth industry, though as yet towns were not a prime residence for most landowners. Nevertheless, they continued to attract migrants, both from within the country and from abroad. Most immigrants went to towns, notably to London, where foreign migrants were about 6 to 10% of the population, but also, for example, to Bristol, to Southampton, to King's Lynn. In Great Yarmouth, there were many foreign brewers. The Low Countries, what we would now call the Netherlands and Belgium, provided the largest groups of immigrants, Flemings being attacked in 1381 during the Peasants' Rising, notably in London, where about 40 were murdered, in part as a product of the anger of native weavers, though the number killed may actually have been much higher, one source claiming 400. Others were killed in the same year in Norwich, other Flemings. Hansa merchants from North Germany, places like Hamburg and Lübeck, were based in the Steelyard, as their base was called in London, were also important, but also were met by hostility to their particular interests. Much as today, hostility to newcomers was more pronounced in periods of economic difficulty than in that of the urban expansion in the 12th and 13th century, though it's worth bearing in mind that that earlier period had seen acute anti-Semitism culminating under Edward I in the expulsion of Jews from England. At the level of individual towns, variety extended to civic politics, and notably the degree of oligarchic control within the town, as well as resistance to it, and also the extent to which there was alignments between control and resistance and local and national noble factionalism, the role of the aristocrats politically. There was certainly in towns and in urban governance a focus on common profit associated in particular with Christian charity to the benefit of townspeople, and with corporate help similarly regarded as central and as part of a relationship that linked past, present and future. In other words, you do something now and your chances of getting a good deal when you die is up, and were eased by gifts and prayers and expressed in them. In practice, political strain, financial pressure, economic pulses all repeatedly complicated this ideal, which indeed helped encourage an emphasis on it. And again, you might think of parallels with modern day social policy and politics. So, for example, building on earlier hostility to restrictions on grazing, for example, the one I mentioned in St. Albans, there were anti-enclosure riots in towns in the late 15th and early 16th centuries, notably in Colchester, Coventry, Norwich, Nottingham, Southampton and York, all of them important towns. And these reflected the determination of commoners to be able to continue to graze livestock and their opposition to enclosures of urban common land by landowners, those landowners potentially including town corporations in whole or part. Although at the same time, we have to be careful because with that classic inclination by historians, many of whom are politically on the left and temperamentally encouraged to emphasize the role of radicalism in the past as some kind of historical justification for their own attitudes today, it has been argued that the extent, for example, of riots in Norwich in 1437 and 1443 has been greatly exaggerated. Certainly, as on the continent, there was a widespread attempt by urban elites in the 15th century to consolidate control. Now, whereas self-governing royal boroughs were effectively independent under the crown, this was not the case with boroughs owned by landlords, whether clerical or lay. Yet the latter towns could enjoy considerable autonomy, in part due to the landlord's need for their prosperity and indeed help, both financial and in other respects. This need could extend to leasing out landlord rights, a process that became more common in the 15th century. Now, the health of the community, both secular and spiritual, was, in the attitudes of the period, helped by expenditure, whether it was on sewers or churches, with crises such as plague, or for that matter, Lollardy, a heretical movement, providing encouragement to action. The most prosperous towns, such as London, Norwich, King's Lynn, and Colchester, proved best able to afford action for a cleaner environment, while Exeter had a sophisticated public water supply system, including a network of underground passages, which can be visited at the present day. The management of human and animal waste was a key topic, and there were frequently repeated steps to improve the running of markets, butchers, and tanneries, in other words, to stop animal corpses floating around in the rivers, and for the collection of rubbish, as well as against urinating in the streets. Poor relief brought together secular and spiritual concerns in action. Towns were also central to culture, as with the mystery plays staged there as a depiction of good and evil. So the Cooper's Pageant, Coopers were people that made barrels, the Cooper's Pageant in York's 1415 Corpus Christi play showed Adam and Eve and a tree between them, a serpent deceiving them with apples, God speaking to them and cursing the serpent, and an angel with a sword casting them out of paradise. The York mystery plays were written down in the 1460s or 1470s, an aspect of the vitality of a local culture that focused on towns. Parish-supported processions, guild pageants, and liturgical celebrations were all, for example, in Bristol, associated with the Feast of Corpus Christi. At the same time, towns had a close and often symbiotic relationship with their hinterlands, and notably so if they were under the seigneurial control of manorial lords, rather than being boroughs with chartered significance. Now, it's true that those under seigneurial control were generally smaller and primarily local market and trade centres. For example, the town of Coleshill in Warwickshire, a relatively small one, was under the Clintons, who were granted powers there by Henry II in 1184-5. Then, as a result of a marriage of an heiress, they were under the Mountfords. And then, after an execution in 1495 for rebelling, they passed to the Digbys. Patronage, in such cases by noble landowners, was important in helping to create links between urban and rural society. It could also lessen the tensions that could arise from economic links or economic problems. And at the same time, there was a frequent process of negotiation in order to resolve differences, to assess, for example, what might be regarded as a fair price, or to determine how much it was reasonable to anticipate that towns should play a role in sort of trying to deal with potholes, a problem that obviously would be inconceivable in the modern age of great progress. As in France, towns tended to look for stable monarchy. They both developed a sense of communal identity and interests, and yet did so within a national and state context that didn't require the independence pursued by towns in Germany and Italy. There was no equivalent to imperial free cities, which existed within the empire in both Germany, what we often call the Holy Roman Empire, in Germany and in northern Italy. In contrast to Henry VI, Edward IV, who was king from 1461 to 70 and 1471 to 83, worked very hard to win the loyalty of London and its leading citizens, on one occasion inviting the mayor and aldermen to join him on a hunting party in Waltham Forest. And this looked towards the care to woo London shown by the Tudors. The only one, I suppose, who might be a bit ambiguous about that would be Mary I. The Duke of Northumberland's rebellion on behalf of Lady Jane Grey started really in London, but she was able to successfully appeal to London for support against Thomas Wyatt's rebellion in 1554, only to become unpopular through her anti-Protestant religious policies. Far less support was to be shown, of course, by London under the Stuarts. There was to be rebellion in London in 1642, 1688, and serious opposition there in 1679 to 81. But in contrast, Wyatt in 1554 and Robert Earl of Essex in 1601 failed to raise support against successive Tudor monarchs, Mary and then Elizabeth I. An absence of urban independence didn't mean a lack of identity. And indeed, an aspect of a distinctive town identity was provided by urban chronicles and by early town maps. A map of Bristol in about 1480 appeared as part of Robert Rickart's manuscript history of the town, a work produced because the mayor sought a record of the rights and franchises of Bristol. Rickart, the common clerk of Bristol, brought in the mythical founding of the town and the 1373 charter that gave it county status. It was under the crown. Status was an important aspect of a more general performative culture and society, with the performance in towns linked to institutional politics and institutional profile within towns. Profile was variously secular, religious, and more commonly both, so guilds and also care for the poor were both secular and religious, and each aspect of profile offered status affirmation and networking. All of these were to be challenged by the Protestant Reformation in the 1530s to 60s. At the same time, any emphasis on the change of the Reformation, or indeed on the arrival of the Tudors in 1485, or any other individual or collective indication of what we might call modernity, whatever that means, seriously risks underplaying the significance of continuity. This was a case of many elements from the built environments, more continuity in towns, for example, between, let's say, 1450 and 1550 than any significant change, or to the social economic contexts of life. These showed scant elements of change, although with the important caveat that the Reformation did bring important elements of development or change at the level of individual towns in both economy and society. There were also major elements of continuity in politics and governance. I mean, I think that raises questions about where we should look at breaks in urban history. And I'm going to press on to suggest that the Reformation was to be a fundamental break with the structures and practices of many aspects of urban society and belief. But at the same time, I want to emphasize an enormous continuity in socioeconomic contexts. Let me just give you an example of that. William Smith's particular description of England, a work written in 1568, 1588, which focuses indeed, as so much of the discussion did, on the south of England. It includes what were known, what he called the portraits of certain of the chiefest cities and towns. It's essentially maps. And he depicted Bath, Bristol, Cambridge, Canterbury, London, Norwich, and Rochester. And such works, as indeed the maps of John Speed, fundamentally recorded views that wouldn't have been out of keeping a century earlier, even if the purposes of some of the buildings might have changed, notably with new functions for what had been monasteries. But nevertheless, if you're looking for continuity, distinctions between town and country remained less marked than they were to become by the 19th century. It's true that towns were centres of manufacturing and trade, but both of these were also pursued in the countryside, not least through processes historians have described as proto-industrialisation, not a term that contemporaries were troubled by. Similarly, there was much market gardening within town walls. There were also urban orchards and pastures, the latter especially valuable for milk, which couldn't be refrigerated, treated, or preserved, and therefore went off very rapidly, which indeed helped encourage the consumption of weak beer. Richard Lynn's LYNE street map of Cambridge in 1574 shows a pig rooting around in nearby Swirecroft, as well as fishing. Indeed, chickens, ducks, and geese were also kept for meat and eggs. John Walker's 1591 map of Chelmsford included not only Bell Meadow, but were also what were called the back sides, that's what were written onto the maps, of the dwellings, which provided them with land for plants and animals. These spaces helped provide family economies with greater resources and resilience, and also ensured work for most of its members. Young children could be expected to tend chickens or pick fruit. And indeed, economic strain on individuals and families were countered by multiple occupations, as well as by using pawning or theft to raise funds and credit. Again, as another example of continuity, a lot of power for the grinding of corn was provided by water mills. Fuel was very much came from wood. Sometimes the exhaustion of local timber meant the need to move wood or coal a distance, Cambridge receiving wood from nearby Essex and Suffolk and coal from distant Newcastle, all of which incidentally were brought by water, by river, which again was the pattern as had been this previous century. There's no particular change. It is true that in the 16th century there was to be general and sustained population growth, but far from that being unique, it had already happened in the 12th and 13th centuries, as indeed had the role of towns as centres of manufacturing, trade, government and leisure. And with the exception of London, towns were small. In 1523, Worcester, for example, ranked 16th among towns in England by population. You might like to pause here and have a guess at what the size of the 16th largest town in England was. Well, the answer is, in 1523, 4,000. And 1666, its population had gone up, but it was to 6,000. The next biggest town in Worcestershire, Evesham, had only about 1,400 people in the mid 16th century, the size of a modern village, indeed of a relatively small one. After London, it's true that Bristol and Newcastle, Norwich, York and Exeter all grew rapidly in the 16th century, despite the travails of disease, notably plague, which in another aspect of continuity hit in the 16th century as it had hit in the 15th and 14th century. So in 1587, it killed nearly a third of the population of Norwich. The population of Norwich, which was England's second largest town, would have been about 15,000 people, so it killed nearly 5,000 of them. There was a disproportionately high number of large towns in the southern half of England, particularly in East Anglia and the southwest, ironically not in the southeast because of the inhibiting impact of London on the growth of nearby towns, and also because it had less industry than the other two regions, and in particular less cloth making and less fishing. But the presence of so many towns in the south of England impacted not only on the economic, but also on the political importance of the area, because it was largely responsible for the high numbers of parliamentary boroughs there. This was also the wealthiest part of England. In the 16th and going forward into the 17th century, some towns enjoyed rapid growth. Although there was an absence of planned development, which was a particular characteristic of the generally haphazard and usually rather intermittent urban growth of the period. I think 20 years ago, we might have said the absence of planned development and all sort of frowned. I think now we're possibly more sceptical about whether planned development is necessarily better than unplanned development that was reactive to the needs and opportunities of the local environment. Well, we're about to discover as the new Labour government forces large numbers of houses on unwilling communities. The situation in the 16th and 17th centuries brought contingency to the fore, but also reflected a situation in which government itself, both national and local, was relatively modest by modern standards in its pretensions and activities. The death penalty, yes, but not the National Health Service. More positively, it's unclear that government was readily capable of providing or supporting planned urban development of any type on any scale or continuity. As a consequence, the situation at the time worked possibly as well as it could have been anticipated and as badly. Certainly, if you're looking at individual towns, economic differentiation was important to success. So in the 16th century, Maidstone developed papermaking and brewing for the London market. There was glove making in Chalbury and Northampton and in Yeovil, whilst Exeter, which had about 8,000 inhabitants and was one of the top five towns in the country, became a major centre for the export of lighter weight new draperies to the Mediterranean. Other towns, however, such as Coventry or Leicester, were affected by declining industries or largely stagnated. Moreover, some, usually smaller towns, were hit by the market integration that lessened the number and or significance of smaller markets. And while some ports did well, for example, Topsham, the outport for Exeter, or King's Lynn, others did less so. I think we might continue next time, Graham. I wonder if you've got any particular points you might like to raise.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. I want to just focus on a particular aspect you said in terms of the charters of towns and the level of independence that was given from the Crown, but also how that related to towns which had one major landowner. And particularly taking that last part and relating it to the feudal system. We think of the feudal system very much really in terms of the countryside, peasants in the fields with their local landowner as their feudal lord. How did that work in towns during this period?
Well, I mean, it didn't work with the same degree of aristocratic control that you might have seen, for example, princely control that you might have seen in those German towns that were not imperial free cities, and even more in, shall we say, Russian or the majority, not all, Polish towns. In essence, what you'd be doing is generally paying the landowner who had seigneurial rights for privileges which were at his disposal, particularly market rights. So you would be paying a weekly sum to use the market.
And could towns develop their own markets without a charter to do so? Was that illegal? What would happen if they did just decide, local farmers getting together, bringing their carts into town and setting up stalls?
Yes, it would be illegal if they didn't have the power. If they didn't have a charter right to do so, that would be illegal. It would be an infringement of a property right, as well as obviously of the local judicial authority of the local judicial power. So, yes, very much so.
And we'll probably come to it in its proper place, but just for listeners eager to know now, when did that system break down?
Well, as you may know, I mean, lordships of the manor can still be bought and sold. Now they essentially have honorary powers, rather like the equivalent, which is rights of presentation to benefices, in other words, appointments over the church. But the power has, in theory, only really went over the last 150 years.
No, that's fascinating. Many people, I think, wouldn't grasp that. And I want to ask a final question, if I may, about the cloth trade and its centrality to the wealth of many towns during this period. How geographically do we see the spread very much in the southeast of England, particularly with mind to the trade with the Low Countries, or is it spread really, wherever there is access to wool, which is, a large part of England in this time, including in the north, but the actual weaving is done in towns?
Well, weaving is, on the whole, done actually in the rural areas, but what you generally have in the towns is what is known as finishing, which might, for example, involve dyeing. You would also have the trade organized in general by urban merchants who would buy it from rural weavers. Arrange for it to be finished in the towns and then transport it to external markets or move it to London where as it were larger merchants would move it onwards. The cloth trade was Britain's biggest sorry, England. Well, actually, there was cloth trade also from Scotland, but it was principally England. It was the biggest industry and also, of course, responsible for the most success for agriculture. So it was really important to the economy.
Well, talking about being finished, I'm afraid we're finished for this episode. My apologies for the extremely poor wordplay there, but fascinating talking about this period of medieval England and the development of towns during it. Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.